Stay hungry, stay foolish.
So now on the Innovation Show, we welcome John Phelan, National Director for the H-Band Network and Chair for Animation Ireland. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Aidan. Good to see you again.
So you're... a little dig in there. I know, you're not the only one. This is one of those nine famous interviews that were deleted. You see, I make it objective, were deleted, not by someone. Thanks for coming back in again, John. Thanks for your time. It'd be great to understand what H-Band Network is and what it does.
Thanks, Aidan. I suppose H-Band, in a nutshell, is a dating agency. It's the easiest way to explain it. H-Band is a Halo Business Angel Network. We're the all-island network for business angels to create that community, I suppose, the idea. What we do is we bring high-net-worth individuals who are looking to invest in reasonably early-stage companies. And that's on one side of the equation. And then on the other side of the equation, we bring good companies that have great potential with good promoters. And we qualify the deal flow as it comes through. So we might get 400 to 500 applications a year. We typically put between 50 and 100 of those in front of angels. So the angels know they're getting good deal flow every year. So that's very important to them. An example I give you is that one of the angel forums I run just down the road here, we had 50 companies last year that were presented over the year. 32 of those have now been invested in, 15 of them through our own network and 17 of them outside our network. Frankly, I don't care as long as they get invested. But what it's showing is that the quality of the deal flow that 60%+ get invested in, which is a huge hit rate. And it's great for our investors to hear that and see that, that the quality is that good.
From a deal perspective, what kind of stuff are you looking for? So if I'm somebody sitting at home and I have an idea, what are you looking for? Like what strikes me off the list automatically and what gets me on the list?
If you're the company side of the equation, what we want to see is a company that has, scalability and real potential. So scalability in our world will be how do you scale technology typically, and it has potential to go global and scale up quite fast with quite limited capital costs. So for example, something that's a tangible good is quite difficult because you've got to invest in the inventory and everything else, whereas if you have an enterprise software play, you build it. But the cost then is really just your sales. You don't have a cost of sales. So the capital costs actually scale it up, and your gross margin, your gross profit tends to reflect that. And we'd be looking for that.
Yeah. So basically your cloud storage or something like that would be the only thing that gets bigger as you get bigger.
So you can scale it.
Yeah. That's brilliant. So.
And I suppose a lot of our investors will come from that world. And they would understand how to do that. And they would understand where the customers are and how to get those customers on board. And that's really important that they bring the smarts to the table, that it's not just cash.
Yeah, so to put it into layman's terms, so Dragon's Den, for example. So you're looking for the network to basically bring good dragons or suitable dragons to the table who know this space.
Yeah.
And they tend to back the horses that they're familiar with.
Yeah, and I say it to all the angels coming in. I say, you're better off sticking to the sectors you know and understand. Because typically what happens is that a lot of the companies that come in to us are well prepped. We have a whole team that preps them before they actually get in front of angels so that they're really investor ready. So through the Irish Business Innovation Centre, the BICS, the companies are brought to a stage where they're investor ready. We then have another team that brings them to presenter ready at that investor ready level so that they can stand up, they can pitch. They can pitch really well. Their content's really strong. The structure of the pitch is really strong. They have a 10-minute presentation. They've got to get that 10-minute hook in to get people interested. If they don't get that, they're out of the game. So it's a really important exercise, and they should put a lot of time into that.
We had Michael Culligan in from Dublin BIC before, and he was saying that you do a lot of work to basically coach the companies through it. So they're not coming in and expecting to be amazing presenters straight away, because you have the great idea guys who aren't very comfortable presenting or talking about the company. So you kind of either matchmake them with somebody who is, or you coach them through those phases.
Yeah, and you try and do either or both, because typically what we'd like to see is somebody who's got a great technology background and understands technically how they're going to do what they say they're going to do. And then on the other side of the equation, you need somebody who's commercially savvy and understands how to bring that tech, communicate where the value is, and understands how to get into the market and onboard customers. And as you said, Dublin Big with Michael Culligan, and what Dublin Big would do is bring them to, they challenge them on all their beliefs and basically beat the hell out of them, which is a bit of tough love, as I like to call it. And I think that system works well because it preps them for the real world, but we do it in a safe environment where we can say things which a lot of other people can't. A lot of the consultants in Dublin BIC would come from the sectors that they get assigned to the companies. So they'd have a deep understanding of what the market is looking for, where the problems are, how you're going to get into the market, all that kind of good stuff that you'd expect out of a normal business, where typically the early stage guys just haven't had that experience. So we try and help them on that front as well.
Yeah, so that, like it's almost drilling skills in before the big game. Yeah. And in that, so like I hate for people to get scared off by it. So if I'm a guy, I'm coming in, I have an idea. Will you help me put a team together? So you might go, listen, before you even present this, like the idea, before you present this, we need you to have a chief marketing officer, or we need you to have you're a great business guy or business development guy. We need a technical guy beside you before you present, because do the angels look at the team?
Oh yeah, absolutely they do, because the team and the promoters are what you're backing, really. The idea is one part of that equation, but ultimately it comes down to if the main promoter and the team can't execute on it, the whole thing's going to fall apart.
And who's the promoter in that? Is the promoter the idea person?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you have the promoter, you have the team, and then you have HBAN behind being the coach, essentially.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so...
I mean, all we do is support the guys. I mean, we don't want to take their glory.
Yeah.
We are really just that coaching element.
Yeah.
And we prepare them so that they can step up to the mark. And our only goal is that they get funded.
Yeah.
And we want to see them do that. We want to see them succeed.
Yeah. So basically what you're doing is going to, in a Tinder world, you're going and you're scouting both sides of the market.
Just sliding everywhere. I'm sliding left and right.
Yeah. So you're actually building the market as well. So you're building the supply side and the demand side.
Yeah. And it's taken us a long time to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been doing this for 8-9 years now. And when we started off, it was a startup. And when we had very, very limited resources. We had very little limited profile access to the market. We didn't know how many angels there was in the country. We now have a recent report from Intertrade Ireland saying that they believe there's somewhere between 120 and 170 million available each year in the angel economy in Ireland, of which HBAN, we would have bought 10 million to the table last year. So there's still a lot out there going on. And I suppose what I'd like to do is say, right, can we build that to 20 million at least? But bring into our sphere more angels who will get better deal flow and better qualified deal flow, so that they get a better chance at a better return.
Yeah. So, okay. So you mentioned about it took you a long time to get there. Yeah. So can we talk about you then for a second and how you got there? So how yourself, because you've a very interesting background. I mentioned your chair of Animation Ireland, so you've obviously a creative streak or a passion there as well. So can we talk about that and how you got to where you are?
That's why, yeah, we can, Aidan. Might take a while.
I have coffee here.
I suppose my first career was animation and games. So I started doing that back in 1987. I started in Sullivan Bluth, like a lot of people in the animation world in Ireland. When Sullivan Bluth shut shop, and it was a great institution. It was a great place to be.
I went there on a school tour when I was in school, like sixth year, and it was awesome. I remember just being mesmerized by, you know, the creativity and the process. But the process actually blew me away. It was like, because you think of when you're that age, you think it's drawing. Yeah. And then you see the process and the precise process of everything.
There's 22 different departments. And of those 22 different departments, they all had a different approval stage within each one. So I describe it's a sausage factory, that production process. And it is a very well-defined process. And I think what they did very well was they had the processes well worked out and defined. And I think that's helped all the studios here, because now the studios here would understand how to do a commercial process and from A to B. So get it from the creative bit and get it out to get the show out on tape or whatever. But essentially the professionalization of a process as opposed to a creative artistic drawing part of it, it's a very big difference.
Yeah. And you've brought that experience, because we've had Dan Spencer from Giant Animation on. I've talked to Cathal Gaffney, and that is very much in the mindset of the companies. And you know, people think of them, they're just creative places, but they actually become technology institutions who do creative.
Yeah, well, I think why Ireland is doing so well in the animation world is that the infrastructure and the professionalization of the management side of it has been embraced. And I do genuinely think the technology that the guys are embracing and using, making things faster, cheaper, and turning it around quicker, which means the budgets come down, means that broadcasters and those who are financing shows can see they're getting better value by coming here. Not just that the talent in terms of the artists and the creatives are all there as well, but also that it's supported by this infrastructure of technology, professional management, and they can turn it around. And the attitude and the culture is good.
Yeah, because I had the fortune to visit both Dan and Giant and also Brownbag, and the servers on site and stuff like that. So there's intelligence there beyond, you know, the guys have thought about the whole process, and it's just fantastic. I was just blown away by it. And but we'll go back to the timeline. So you're in Sullivan Bluth. That's where your creative juices started flowing.
Yeah. And then listen, I was a kid. It was all great fun. The average age, I think, was about 22. So there's lots of energy in the place. And they went through, I suppose, their own ups and downs, and eventually wound up in 95. 94. I ended up going to Warner Brothers in the UK. Warner Brothers, we did Space Jam and a few others with Michael Jordan over there. Great exposure to the UK scene. After about 18 months, Warner Brothers said, it's too expensive here, we're leaving. So I said, that's good. Can I take all your desks and equipment and 40 staff down the road and I'll subcontract from the States all the other stuff?
Brilliant.
So we did.
And what was your role to be able to do that at the time?
Well, I set up my own company.
Yeah, but within Sullivan Bluth and then Warners, yeah.
Within Warners, I was on the production side, so okay. I was production manager.
Wow.
So
you spotted the opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, hey. And actually what came about was the network from the Sullivan Bluth days, who a couple of guys in LA had said that our studio is looking for outsource work. Do you want to do it? And we ended up doing $1 million in our first year. So it was a great. Yeah.
And you're still in your 20s then?
I was 25, 26.
Yeah, early 20s. Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing.
Brilliant.
Frankly. And I suppose for the 4 or 5 years we did that. And that company actually, strangely enough, was called Giant, which I always slagged the off with. But so we had a studio called Giant where we did a lot of service work for the States, for the large studios, for 20th Century Fox, DreamWorks, Warners. And we started doing commercials and we started doing some TV projects and doing a lot of co-pros with German companies, Spanish companies and everything else. So I suppose there was a huge amount of learning there. The learning from my side was that this is not just a creative process. Actually, you have to professionalize this. And that opened my eyes a lot. I also saw at the time that Toy Story came out. And I could see how that was killing the 2D world, which is the hand-drawn world, which is what we had come out of. And I think, frankly, we were quite snobby about 2D versus 3D. And we got caught up in all that. And Again, all that technology can be very humbling when you realize how wrong you are.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to get a kick in the ass every so often. But after that, I went to the States to head up a game studio, which was a mixture, again, of a lot of creative artists on one side of the house. And it was a split like that. On one side of the house was all the artists doing all the pictures. And then on the other side of the house was all the dev heads coding in their caves. Yeah. And it was like, how do you bring these two cultures together and get them working together and doing what we needed to do? And all our clients were Disney, Mattel, Warners again. So it was a good, again, it was great learning. March 2001 came along. The dot bomb blew the hell out of that market because the games publishing market, that business model changed. I came back from that because all our clients reined in all their funds and said, we don't know where this market's going to be, so we're not spending anymore. And we were doing between whatever, 7 to 10 million a year at that stage. So when I came back here, I said, right, I'm going to get out of this. And I had a family, so we said, we want to stay in Ireland. How are we going to do that? So I went back to school and went back to college and did my MBAs, my QFAs, my corporate financy stuff. And
so it's a far cry from the creative stuff you were doing.
It was, but at the why I went back to do that was I identified there was a lot of things I knew about setting up a business, doing the creative side, everything else. But where I felt I really didn't understand was how do you assess a market, an industry, and see where it's going? And how do you position yourself to be a leader in that market rather than being a laggard who floats on the coattails of everybody else and then gets murdered at the end of it, which is what I saw happening in the animation industry. I saw close on 5,000 people losing their livelihoods who were 2D artists because they didn't read the market. And I just wanted to understand that. I wanted to understand how do you actually assess a market and how do you see where it's going to be in 3 to 5 years' time so that you can aim to lead that as opposed to follow it up.
That mindset is very rare when you had that because businesses are still struggling with that and still don't do that. And despite innovation programs, they still don't do that. And what resonated with me was what you said about the tech team in one silo and the creative team in another silo. We see that still in so many companies. And Steve Jobs, he challenged that by putting the coffee shop in the middle to create this kind of watering hole that everybody would come together and graze together on their pasture.
And I suppose that as much as a myth, I'm not saying that the Steve Jobs one, I'm saying, and it is a myth that they are two different cultures that need to be kept separate. They just naturally drift into that.
Yeah,
because if you allow it to drift, it will. Whereas if you mix it up and bring them together and you bring that diversity together, they start finding that they have things in common and that they should be talking to each other. And then it all works fine.
Yeah. But you just, it's a good point.
Breaking down those barriers.
Yeah, on a constant basis. Yeah. So, back to the timeline. So, that was really, the mindset you had was so advanced in a way that you were doing, the reasons you were doing it, people go and do an MBA or a finance degree to understand finance or business or because they can. You know, it's not what a really defined purpose that you seem to have.
Yeah.
And it's becoming apparent the more we hear from you, John, is that how you've created the mindset you have and where you are is actually just perfect for that mindset.
Yeah, I suppose when you get quite a lot of setbacks and you see an industry's going down that you're quite passionate about, it is a humbling experience. It does require you to reflect on it and to be very open about it. Because people's livelihoods are at stake here and people have lost jobs and worse. So, I think be open, share the love, as I keep saying to everybody.
It's funny because that, and it's something I hadn't heard before, but we had Porico KG on the show a couple of weeks back and he talked about when you have those constant setbacks, it creates these new synapses in your brain almost where you don't see them anymore. You actually just don't see those kind of obstacles because you become, I suppose your skin hardens a little bit, your mental skin, you kind of get a bit harder to those. But also your warning signals or your radar or it becomes stronger for potential threats.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like if you go back to your rugby days, Aidan. I mean, the more you train and the more you observe and the more your coaches tell you that, look out for this, this, and this, and then you do it the first couple of times, it can be quite a struggle to do it, and you might mess it up, and that's fine. But then it becomes part of your toolkit, and you just do it, and you don't even realize you're doing it. So the more you challenge yourself to do things that you don't feel comfortable doing, I think my own experience would be that it becomes part of the norm. And then once it's part of the norm, it just gets done. You don't even think about it. Whereas if you always say, no, I'm not going to do that because that's difficult, it'll always be difficult.
That's a really good point, because brain scientists talk about that actually, and they say that habits are formed because your brain wants to save energy. That's an energy saving machine. So it actually saves those things as habits. Yeah. And the other thing was with threats, because I always used, when I coached rugby, I talked about this, was if you ask somebody who was in a violent attack about the incident, they'll remember the weapon. They won't remember what the person looked like usually, but they'll remember the weapon, because the brain is trained to look for the most dangerous threat first. And in a rugby setup, you kind of, what I was training the guys to do was, if they're coming to a ruck, so apologies for anybody who doesn't like rugby or not, but when they're coming to a breakdown, to identify where the biggest threat is coming from the opposition. Yeah. Because if you do that, you will see it like you did. Yeah. You'll see those threats coming down the line in any facet. And then you create a habit of them, and then you just see them always. So
then you move on to the next one.
Yeah, you build up.
You would hope that you get up to a higher plane in terms of your levels of understanding.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think constantly challenging yourself and moving on up is good.
So then you completed the MBA. What was the next step?
Then I did QFA, which is Qualified Financial Advisor, and then Corporate Finance. And I suppose my rationale for all of those was that I was getting very stuck into the early stage companies through the likes of Dublin Big. I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the challenge of not understanding what the hell was going on and meeting guys who didn't understand what the hell was going on. But then having a framework around how to assess what they were trying to do, and being able to create a business model with them. I suppose the alma mater from here will be Mark Little in terms of Storyful and how we sat in a room and beat the hell out of each other for several months trying to figure out what the business model was. And it eventually came down to something very simple, which was syndicated news just coming out of different sources. But it took us 6 months to get to that.
Yeah.
And we went through a whole different, lots of different cycles of that.
Yeah.
And doing that with lots of different people in lots of different sectors, I just find it stimulating. I think it's really interesting. It's really challenging to try and sort it out and to try and help them. It keeps you awake at night, gets you up early in the morning, just trying to figure out what's the solutions here.
Yeah.
So I do that with all the early stage guys, but then the later stage companies, so I work with quite a lot of later stage companies as well, which would be the 10 to 20 million companies who are well established, but they need a strategy for growth from where they are. And typically where they are in a mature sector, which they need to understand how do they differentiate themselves from the competition. How do they reposition themselves? What's the new lines of product or service going to be? And how are they going to do all that? And it's a very different mindset, because you've got a lot deeper cultural issues to look at. And then you've got to move the technology, you've got to move the culture, you've got to move the politics, and then you've got all the competition around it. So it's all just interesting sort of, how do you put this whole jigsaw together to create something which the whole company recognizes is the right way to go, and they're with you.
Yeah.
And that's not easy to do.
Well, yeah, but I mean, listening to you to this morning, you understand, I mean, you have serious credibility there, because you've been, it's not always about the successes. It's not about the successful things. It's actually from, you know, witnessing and being part of the crashes. And, you know, as you see the crashes and burns and seeing the murder on the dance floor that you've seen is you know, I mean, that leaves the scars that you actually want to avoid in the future. And, you know, the financial stuff, that's really interesting, John, that you've done that, because, you know, I struggle with that. I kind of hate business plans because, and, you know, a lot of times people in entrepreneurship and innovation kind of go, oh, yeah, you don't need a business plan, but you need to understand and assess the market.
If you're trying to get $1 million out of somebody, I think you should do them the honor of at least understanding your market. By going in and saying that I have a great idea, and give me $1 million, I don't think respects their money or their time even. If you want to prove it, you've got to show them that you understand where the real opportunity is. And that means you've got to understand what the competition is doing. You've got to understand how big the marketplace is. You've got to understand where the margins are. You've got to understand the pricing. You've got to understand what differentiates you. And you've got to understand the value proposition. A lot of those things probably second nature to you and I now, but I know a lot of people coming through it the first time wouldn't understand that.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely fine. That's just a stage of development. So hopefully we can help them to understand what the expectations will be. But what I have seen in the last 5 years even is the maturity of the startup market, both on the company side, but also on the investor side. And I think it has matured greatly over the last couple of years. The expectations from both sides have professionalized. And yeah. I think that's great.
But it's also, I mean, and tip of the cap to HBAN and Dublin BIC and all the other entities, because there's that paying it back as well. And I going back to the rugby as well, I see that as well in rugby, where ex-players now are coaching, yeah. Ex-professional players are coaching. And that's a huge difference from what was happening 10, 20 years ago. Last question for you, John. So if I am a guy with an idea, and I'm going, okay, I need to distill those ideas down into 5 slides, yeah. What should those 5 slides say?
If you go onto the HBAN website, we have a new video up there. And the new video actually shows you exactly what you need to do in your presentation. It shows you what the content should have. It shows you what the structure should be. And it shows you how you should deliver it. So if you get those 3 things right, and you deliver it with energy and passion, not over passionate, confident but not cocky, you're setting yourself up for a good presentation with potential investors.
Okay, and what's the site?
It's www.hban.org.
Okay. Well, John Phelan, National Director for HBAN and Chair for Animation Ireland, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aidan. Good to see you.